It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
I can hear you. I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people... And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Those are the words of President George W. Bush in the days following the terrorist attacks on 9/11, 20 years ago tomorrow. And this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to First Amendment Friday. We're going to give you a chance to sound off today. And I know that a lot of you have things to say, especially given the state of the world right now, with dictates coming down from the president or dictator, Joe Biden, who's decided that he has more power than the United States Congress and the courts combined, even though he can't manage to exit from Afghanistan without leaving, as we're speaking right now, 100 Americans hostage in Afghanistan at the tender mercy of the Taliban. The Taliban, who controlled Afghanistan 20 years ago before the United States went in on the hunt for Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and the people who brought the towers down and brought that plane down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and the attack on the Pentagon as well. So we're going to make lots of time for calls today on First Amendment Friday. And you're going to hear some voices today like this. This was Bryant Gumbel 20 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. There is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. It would appear that there has been another major explosion, this one in the nation's capital. This is coming at 9:43 Eastern Time.
Now, think about where we stood on that Tuesday morning, September 11, 2001, what life was like, what it was like on September 10th, and how it changed forever on September the 11th, and how the terrorist attacks changed us, and more importantly, how they did not change this country or the people necessarily to make America safer. And we have to think about what it must have been like to be on one of those airplanes on that day 20 years ago as Islamic terrorists turned them into deadly missiles. Listen to this.
Nobody moved. Everything would be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll injure yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet. Nobody move, please. We're going back to the airport. Don't try to make any stupid moves.
Now, you may not realize it, but today, 20 years or tomorrow, 20 years after the 9/11 attacks, the United States is still in a state of national emergency. Every single year, every single president since then has sent a letter to the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House renewing that national emergency declaration. It never ended. The White House, in fact, yesterday released Joe Biden's letter. It says, in part, the terrorist threat that led to the declaration on September 14th, 2001 of a national emergency continues. Listen to this as it happened 20 years ago.
It is September 11th, the year 2001. This time now is approximately 7:36 a.m.
That was an explosion.
America did go after the Taliban in Afghanistan immediately, and Al-Qaeda, and Osama bin Laden, which was the correct course at the time. It then kept us in America's longest war until this year, when Joe Biden managed to turn our exit from Afghanistan into a debacle that took more lives, took the lives of service members, left the Taliban with hostages, 100 Americans at today's count. And we finally hunted down Osama bin Laden and sent him off to hell. And since we're aware of the threat now, in a way, we were not aware of it on September the 10th. That gives us some measure of protection. I thought that Jonathan Tobin, not Jeffrey Toobin, Jonathan Tobin made a good point this week about the charge that was used against America by many of those who hate America, the one that favors the terrorists, that our country is somehow Islamophobic, and that's the root of the problem. It isn't true, of course, but Tobin wrote, "We're reminded that due to a bizarre decision of the Anti-Defamation League to commemorate the attack on America this year by revisiting the decision to oppose the building of an Islamic center, a mosque, in the shadow of the fallen Twin Towers of the World Trade Center." That was done away with 10 years ago. In the immediate aftermath of the terrorist assaults, it was clear what had happened. Al-Qaeda, a radical Islamic terror group led by Osama bin Laden, took their fight against the West to the United States and wound up killing nearly 3,000 Americans. Like it or not, a variant of Islam that could count on considerable support and sympathy from extremist believers forced the West to realize, like it or not, that we were in a war against those forces. President Bush and the rest of the country, he writes, as well as the American media and entertainment industry, went to great lengths to point out that the conflict was only with the radicals who had attacked America and not with all Muslims. And I agree with that. But he says, but almost immediately, a counter-narrative about 9/11 began to be put forward. At this reading, the real story wasn't about those who committed the atrocities and their ideology and the way that they were linked to other dangerous groups seeking to topple moderate Arab governments and those waging war on the existence of the State of Israel. Instead, for some, the most important thing about 9/11 was that it gave birth to a surge of Islamophobia. I know, ridiculous. A decade ago, groups like the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which served as a fundraising and PR front for groups like the terrorist group Hamas, condemned the mythological Islamophobia in America. They even pushed to have that Muslim mosque built at Ground Zero in New York City. Thankfully, that effort died about a decade ago. Every single American president should remember what was done to this country 20 years ago, who did it, why they did it, and then identify threats from the same kind of groups that might someday try to do it again. Listen to Donald Trump.
This is your anniversary of personal and permanent loss. It's the day that has replayed in your memory 1,000 times over. The last kiss, the last phone call, the last time hearing those precious words, "I love you."
Donald Trump commemorating the anniversary on one of the years over the last 20 where we have marked this terrible anniversary, but a terrible reminder of the kind of threats this country faces and still faces today. As I said, the State Department has now admitted that after Joe Biden less than a month ago vowed that he would not leave Afghanistan, that American troops would not leave Afghanistan until every single American had been brought out. And then they brought a few more out earlier this week. And we know as of today, the State Department says at least 100 Americans are still on the ground in Afghanistan and still need to be rescued. And they are still effectively the hostages of the Taliban. Just exactly how far have we moved since the terrible day, 9/11/2001? It is the day before that anniversary. I'll be glad to take your phone calls. It's First Amendment Friday as well. And coming up in a moment, while America faces lots and lots of threats from abroad, as Abraham Lincoln once warned us, the biggest threats to America are domestic threats. And his name is Joe Biden. We'll talk about that, and I'll give you my take on it in just a moment. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
They're the names of men and women who began their day at a desk or in an airport, busy with life. They're the names of people who faced death and in their last moments called home to say, "Be brave. And I love you."
Tomorrow, we mark 20 years since the terrorist attacks on American soil that most never could have imagined. Our prayers go out to all those who lost somebody on that day, and of course, to the families of those who died or were badly hurt and wounded, hunting down the terrorists responsible. Today, we're watching an equally unimaginable attack on America, this time from the president. Last night, acting unconstitutionally, and try to find me a lawyer who thinks that what Biden announced last night is constitutional or legal. Joe Biden announced that he would force vaccination or draconian conditions on nearly every single working American against the threat of being fired. People like Biden call themselves public servants. He's been doing it nearly his entire adult life. But his tone last night was anything but that of a servant. He said, quote, My message to unvaccinated Americans is this: we've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin. Does that sound more like a servant or a master? Speaking of patience, not even 8 months into this fraud of a president, his approval ratings have dropped to the 30s, with most Americans disapproving of his job performance. We have crazy gas prices, the highest inflation in a decade, and millions of Americans refusing to go back to work. Why? Because Joe is paying them not to. He's even negotiating with the Taliban for American hostages. The number of hostages at this hour still in Afghanistan, 100 Americans. And now we have the vaccine mandate that Biden promised he would never seek. And if you say, Lars, he didn't actually promise that, I'll play the audio for you later. Both Biden and everyone who speaks for him said in the recent months, we're not going to go for a mandate. There's going to be no mandate. It would be wrong to have a mandate. That was from Joe Biden, which is nearly certain to get shot down by the courts. But for the time being, this shows us his attitude and the attitude of people like him, Democrats in our government, toward the citizens. You are not citizens. You are subjects. Do what you're told. Pay your taxes. Shut up and take the jab. Unlike the Taliban or Osama, we know where to find America's latest enemy this time, and it's the White House. On Getter, my friend Jimmy offered up this analysis today. 2.1 million civilian federal workers, 500,000 are unvaccinated. Biden says they'll be fired. Biden is about to become the greatest conservative president ever. He's about to get rid of so much unnecessary spending. And from Facebook, Celeste writes in, Lars, we've now left the state of Oregon, but we love your show, and now we listen from South Dakota. You're so great to call it like it is and call all that Joe has done as intentional. No one, no media outlet has told the truth. He ran on open borders. His regime is now a 100% success, and he did it all intentionally. He should be tried for treason. Thanks, and keep up the good work. You're wonderful, even when we disagree. Signed, Celeste. And on Twitter, Steven Crowder, who's just absolutely great, said, if I owned a company with approximately 100 employees, and I should explain, Joe Biden's vax mandate applies to private companies with 100 employees and more or more. So Crowder says, if I owned a company with approximately 100 employees, I'd find 15 of them who are non-essential, likely the ones with Biden stickers, and I'd fire them. And our question of the day from Sheila, Lars, local non-union male lady here. I recently enrolled my kids in public school after being in private school for many years. We loved our private school, but ultimately planned to transfer them in junior high. We're now in the Forest Grove School District. We were stunned to hear our kids were told to declare their pronouns on their name tags, though I respect or at least tolerate those who use their pronouns. I do not think it's acceptable policy for schools to push. This is a personal, private matter that does not need to be declared publicly by a grade or middle schooler. What's next? Will they be pressured to declare their race, declare their sexual orientation, be segregated by eye and hair color? I can only imagine that we are the only school district implementing this policy that does not make my students feel inclusive, but rather divides them further, signed their mother, Sheila. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, he doesn't get the Daily Grill on a regular basis. In fact, not even all that often at all. Although I think he does things almost every day that would deserve a good grilling. But I'm giving today's Daily Grill on the eve of 9/11 to Joe Biden for speaking to the American people as though they are his subjects and they are testing his patience. Just remember, Joe, you govern based on the consent of the governed. And by the way, Americans have always known for hundreds of years what to do with tyrannical governments. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and even a signing bonus. Online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Lisa Rogers writes in from Rick Rial, Lars, normally I agree with you on every topic, but this one you've missed. You say people are not applying for the open positions because they're all getting unemployment checks. I disagree. I'm currently unemployed. I'm perfectly capable of getting a job. I cannot and will not wear a mask 8 hours a day. I'm married, and my husband has his own business, so we have income. Therefore, I will choose to start my own web design business and meet with clients via Zoom. Signed, Lisa Rogers and Rick Riehl. Well, the fact is, we don't disagree all that much. The ones I'm talking about are the ones sitting at home doing absolutely nothing, while Oregon, by the way, I got the numbers. Oregon has 121,000 people on unemployment. The State Employment Division says there are 98,000 open jobs. Now, does that suggest a really, really obvious solution? 120,000 unemployed, 98,000 open jobs? Why, we could cut unemployment down below 1% if some people would just get off their duffs and go back to work. Now, let's go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network on this eve of 9/11. What's on your mind today on a First Amendment Friday?
Hi, Lars. Thank you. I'm just scared that I'm really going to quit my job because I'm not going to take no vaccine, and I make about $120,000 a year, and they're going to lose about $30,000 of taxes that I pay. I don't think Biden's really thinking everything through.
I don't think he's been thinking. In fact, I'm not even sure he's thinking much. I seriously mean that his wife, who always calls herself a doctor, even though not a medical doctor, ought to be considerate of her husband. Her husband is failing in front of America and God and everyone else. And she ought to do the country a favor and her husband a favor by not subjecting him to this kind of humiliation. But if you've got $120,000 skills, Jeff, I know that you're going to have no problem finding another job. But you're right. When they start to push these kinds of mandates and say, you must do this and you must do that, it is your decision, it is no one else's decision, and you are entitled to it. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about the lawsuit that's already been filed against Governor Kate Brown's order to fire employees who've said no to the jab. And it's First Amendment Friday. We'll get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land?
He did not land.
Oh, he's down?
Yes, somewhere up northeast of Camp David.
That was one of the sounds you heard in the days following 9/11 and the terrorist attacks 20 years ago tomorrow, and we're remembering that today on this First Amendment Friday. And there are other issues that we have to talk about today as well, and one of them is mask mandates and vaccine mandates. It seems as though from every single prominent Democrat in America, we've got mandates coming down from Governor Kate Brown of Oregon, from Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State. And of course, last night, a thoroughly illegal and unconstitutional dictate that's coming down from the White House as Joe Biden tells citizens of a free country, we, meaning I guess the government, are losing patience with you, meaning the people we used to refer to as citizens. So there's got to be a way to fight back. And one of the guys behind the fight back is Jason Dudash, director of the Freedom Foundation Oregon chapter. Jason, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So what is happening now? Let's go to the mandates or dictates, whichever you want to call them, coming down from people like Governor Kate Brown and Jay Inslee. In this case, Kate Brown has said, get vaccinated, take the jab, or you lose your job. Although it seems there are a number of labor unions that have managed to win some kind of exemption at all kinds of levels in both of the states. What's the Freedom Foundation going to do?
Yeah, Lars, our governors over here, the dynamic dimwit duo on the West Coast, they've managed to set an arbitrary deadline of October 18th of going to public employees across our state, people who have dedicated their careers in service to Oregonians and Washingtonians, and tell them that you will lose everything. Everything you have worked for your entire career will be for nothing if you don't do as I tell you. And we're, of course, talking about the vaccine. And that's entirely absurd. Nothing about these orders makes any logical sense. And we're talking about people who have worked through the pandemic up until this point. They're people that we have trusted to educate our kids for the last 20 years, but certainly the last 19 months we've been in this pandemic. They're people we've trusted with our health care to take care of our family members in the hospital. And now Governor Kate Brown is looking at them and saying, now you're too dangerous. Now this deadline that I've decided means you simply cannot work anymore. And that doesn't make any sense.
And so your group, I'm sorry, go ahead. Who are you representing? Because this is quite a spread of people, from a bus driver to a fire chief and others, right?
Yeah, we're representing six public employees that fall under all three of her mandates, her executive order for executive branch staff, and the OHA mandates that cover healthcare workers and school employees. As you mentioned, we have a fire chief, a orthodontist, a DOJ special agent, people who have dedicated their lives to serving Oregonians. And what's interesting about them is they have all been infected and recovered from COVID. They've all been informed by their doctors that they have robust natural immunity to this virus, that all available science at this point says is just as effective, if not more effective, than vaccinated immunity. And under the governor's current guidelines, there is no caveat for these people. Even when their doctors are saying that they should not get the vaccine, they will still lose their jobs under the current governor's orders. And that's what we're challenging here.
Well, and Jason, if I can amplify that a little bit, I mean, I have plenty of arguments with public employees and PERS and things like that. But many of these people are working toward a pension someday. They're not just being put out of work at a particular agency like the DOJ or the Department of Corrections or the fire department. If they're working on a PERS pension, they've been made unemployable by this. Correct me if I'm overstating this. They've been made unemployable everywhere in the state where they could finish filling out their pension, right?
Yeah, Lars, I believe you're correct. And more than that, and what can only be interpretive as either vindictive or punitive, the state has now said that these people will not be eligible for unemployment. And there is simply no reason for this. It is callous. It is disgusting. And this is the kind of behavior that you can expect from a governor who spent the last 19 months ruling by executive fiat and not coming out of her governor's mansion and looking these people, these Oregonians, who her mandates are affecting in the eyes.
Well, and by the way, one of the other elements to this, you kind of hinted at it, but is there a political component to this? I don't want you to give away your trial strategy or your court strategy, but can we say that some of this is aimed politically at people because the governor and Governor Inslee and Joe Biden have all of them have at one point or another characterized, well, the foolish Trump supporters, conservatives, they're the ones not taking the shot. Now, public opinion polls don't support that, but is there a political component to what's being done here that they're taking advantage of a crisis, a manufactured crisis, to say, let's get back at people who may be ideologically on the other side?
Yeah, Lars, you're exactly correct. These governors, they are the lowest of the low. They are playing politics with people's livelihoods. They want this narrative so badly to be true that the only people who are unvaccinated at this point are far-right Looney Tunes. And that's just not the case. These are our neighbors. These are the people that we've worked shoulder to shoulder with through this whole thing, who for some reason, very valid reasons, have chosen not yet to get vaccinated. And that is their constitutional right to do that. And we are going to stand up for every single one of these people and do as much as we can to push back on these mandates, because what these governors are doing is vile. It's disgusting. And we can't let it happen.
By the way, Jason, I'm going to throw this out and then I'm going to move on to some calls. It is 9/11, it's First Amendment Friday. I've had a lot of people asking me, they say, well, how do I go for a religious exemption or a medical exemption? There's a group that it is just like your group. Freedom Foundation is a great nonprofit, but there's one called First Liberty Institute. You can find them at firstliberty.org, and they put together a legal toolkit, not for lawyers, but for people like me who have no law degree. It's just letters that you can fill out with your own name and everything else, submit to your boss and say, I want a religious exemption or I want a medical exemption, and they're backing people up on this. Again, it's firstliberty.org, spelled the way it sounds. Jason, thanks so much for what the Freedom Foundation is doing.
Thanks, Lars. And people can find that same thing on our website at freedomfoundation.com.
Glad to have you do that. Thank you so much for the call. It's First Amendment Friday. Let's go to Seattle, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and the great KVI. Hey, Brady, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, I'm listening on my phone, actually. But, people need to read that FDA letter, because there's some real, it's a total scam that this is an FDA approval, and it's even more so, the Pfizer and this company that makes this Comirnaty, which is BioNTech, it's not even Pfizer, it's a contracted vaccine manufacturer of Pfizer, they both have legal immunity, right? So they are not liable for reactions or death from these jabs. But if you read that FDA approval letter, what it does is it's giving authorization for production, labeling, and use of this new, that's not available yet, this Comirnaty vaccine. But there's still pages and pages of testing, and that letter acknowledges that there's a risk of pericarditis and myocarditis, right?
Yep.
And the testing that is required, the report and the testing is required back to the FDA in 2024 and 2025. So who's liable when a company forces their employees to take these jabs? Who has the liability? Because these are still experimental. I mean,
yeah. And Brady, you've hit on one of the most important elements of this, because while it's voluntary, if you take it, then it's on you. And maybe the pharma company doesn't have liability, but if the government forces you on it on you, or your employer forces on you, then who gets the liability at that point if it doesn't work out well? We'll get to more of your phone calls. Great call, Brady. And in a moment, we'll talk about some of the people losing their jobs. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. I'm going to go right to your calls after I tell you about a doctor. I want to mention this to you because I want you to realize that some of you may be cheering when you see Jay Inslee and Kate Brown say, you will get vaccinated or you will be fired. Okay, I just want you to understand the collateral damage that comes from this. I'm going to leave the name off of it, although based on his circumstances, you might actually be able to identify this person. But wrote to me and said, a byproduct of Washington State healthcare providers losing their licenses in October and being deemed criminals at the same time will be loss of services. I have a small 1,200 kids per year mobile surgical practice in which I travel throughout the state of Washington providing services. So he's helping kids. Now, he's a doctor, so you say, well, he's helping kids and he's making money. Yes, he does. Everybody who has a particular skill in medicine ought to make a really good paycheck. But he's helping out 1,200 kids a year in what he does. I began this project 5 or 6 years ago when I realized the need. Some 95% are covered under the state Medicaid system. What he's saying by saying that is they're poor kids, which are among the lowest paying in the country. Doctors who get their fees paid by Medicaid do not make top dollar. They usually get, you know, I don't know, 60 cents on the dollar. It says, no mystery why nearly no one will provide this care. After 20 years in Washington, I will be sad to go. I'll miss climbing and skiing. Fortunately, my skill set is my own. The state has nothing to do with my ability to perform surgery. People exist outside the wires of Washington, and I will be blessed to serve them. Have a wonderful day. I'll continue to enjoy your show from wherever I land, DKB. Now, I want you to think about this for a moment. You hear the governor say, we're going to make everybody get vaccinated. And you may say, well, great, that's good. Now, do you understand what's happening here? This doctor is saying, I can take my skills anywhere I want. If they don't want me here and they're going to tell me I have to get vaccinated or else you have to leave, he's saying, fine, I'll leave. And if you're one of the parents of those 1,200 kids that this doctor has worked on in his mobile surgical practice, and you say, what happens when we need him again? You say, well, Governor Inslee just effectively fired him by turning him into a pariah. If you believe that that's the right way to do things, please let me know. Let's talk to Lori, who's calling in. Lori, I used to have a friend who lived in your neighborhood. I want to make sure. The city in Iowa is Des Moines, and the city in Washington is Des Moines. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, no, you're totally correct. It's right by SeaTac Airport in Washington State.
My friend Ann Rule used to live in that neighborhood. So tell me what's on your mind on a First Amendment Friday.
Well, two really quick things. Number one, everyone in the government and the media kept predicting a big surge in the fall. And I think one of the ways they may have done that is allowing the legal aliens across the border and then distributing around the country. And then lo and behold, our ICU units are, they say, overwhelmed, although I don't think statistically that's true. But isn't anyone researching who are these people that are unvaccinated and how many of them are illegal aliens? That really concerns me.
It concerns me too, Lori, and I hate to say I can't find out those numbers, and I'll tell you why. Because if you call either the Sanctuary State of Oregon or Sanctuary State of Washington, they'll say to you, we don't take any note of the fact that somebody's an illegal. We are a sanctuary for illegal aliens. Therefore, they won't even give you the data. But I think you're absolutely right. When you saw in I think it was May, 170,000, June was over 200,000, July was over 200,000. I haven't heard the number yet for August. September's likely to be high as well. We're talking about a total, the count I saw was 1.3 to 1.5 million illegals. And they said oftentimes when they were coming across, up to 20% of them were sick with COVID. And they were held for a few days and then immediately put on an airplane with no picture ID and flown to all corners of the United States. It would take, you don't have to be an epidemiologist to say, is that a great way to spread a disease around a country? And I think you're absolutely on target about that. The other question that I think you should consider too, Lori, is this. Kate Brown got $4 billion from the federal government in COVID money. And Jay Inslee got a similar amount in Washington State. Now, last year, every hospital in both states was saying, we're really concerned about being overwhelmed. And they knew that the surge could happen again. So you say, so how much of that $4 billion did you spend to build additional, you know, to go to the hospital and say, look, you had this many ICU beds, we need twice as many. And what's that going to cost to make that happen in ventilators or personnel or training or space or whatever it takes? Because an ICU is, frankly, a hospital room with a lot of really specialized gear in it and a specialized personnel to watch over people, usually at a lower patient nurse ratio than you have in a regular hospital room. So it's not impossible to create more space. And yet, when you look at the number of ICU beds in Oregon and Washington from last year to this year, they didn't expand it. Now, how do you explain that when both states got billions of dollars and they could have gone to the hospital and said, look, we'll give you a chunk of cash, but you've got to expand your capability should this happen again, because it's very likely it may. And they didn't do that, did they?
Yeah, absolutely. They have no interest in doing that. You can't control a society if you help them. And they're not interested in helping people, including the unemployed, Lars. I have to say, every job that I'm qualified for, they have a vaccine mandate, and that includes all of the state positions, which, of course, I believe is illegal. So I'm sitting here today trying to figure out, do I fill out these applications? Because I'm not going to go against my doctor's advice. A lot of people have medical reasons, not just religious reasons and not just philosophical reasons. It could
you know
be
what,
all
Lori,
of the above.
Can I make a suggestion? Apply for one of the jobs and hand them a vaccine mandate, because as I understand federal law, your ability to be accommodated by an employer would be the same as if you rolled in there in a wheelchair and they said, oh, we don't hire people in wheelchairs. They can't do that either. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I think most of you have heard me talk about my experiences on 9/11, but they're really relatively minor because I observed it from a distance as I live on the left coast of America. For the 9/11 terrorist attacks now 20 years ago, the experience was very much more upfront and personal for Terry Strada, who is now the national chair of the 9/11 Families and Survivors United for Justice Against Terrorism. Ms. Strada, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this, because this is a tough memory for you and for your family and friends.
Yes, it certainly is. Thank you.
Tell me about that day, that day on 9/11, because all of us remember it slightly differently. But what was going on that morning for you and your family?
Yeah, that right. Thank you. That morning started out like any other, you know, Tuesday morning when Tom was going to get up early to go to work. He worked on Wall Street. We lived in New Jersey at the time, and we had three children in the house. They were 7, 4, and 4 days old. So I guess that Tuesday was a little bit different with a newborn in the house. I was up early taking care of Justin, and it was my daughter's first day of nursery school, and my oldest son wasn't feeling well, so I was trying to decide whether to keep him home or not. Tom got ready and left for work with my brother, who was visiting at the time, and they went into Manhattan. And as soon as he got up to work, he called just to check in on the kids, and that was a short conversation. But then a little bit later, the phone rang again, and I almost didn't answer it. I just stepped out of the shower and was getting ready to get Caitlin off to nursery school when I picked it up, and it was Tom again, and this time it was a very frantic phone call with a lot of noise and screaming in the background. And, you know, he worked on Wall Street for 20 years, and I'd heard a lot of things going on in the background of his office, but nothing like this ever before. It was just a very frantic sound from everyone. And he explained to me that a plane had hit the building. I was standing in front of the television at the time, and there was nothing on the news. I just assumed it was a small airplane. He said that he had was going to the stairwell with some friends who had cell phones, and that he was going to try to get out. We had a few private words to each other because it really did sound pretty awful, and we hung up the phone, and that was the last time I ever spoke to my husband. Within seconds, it came on the TV. So then I saw what the world was seeing. I saw the North Tower, you know, with this gaping hole in it and fire coming out of it and the black smoke just billowing out of it. And I just started to scream at, to my mother, who was there, because Justin had just been gone. I said, he can't get out of that. No, nobody can get out of that. I mean, it absolutely looked horrific.
Tell me this. Would you mind describing for my audience exactly where your husband worked within that building?
Yes. So he was on the 104th floor. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. There's Windows of the World was the restaurant, was up on the 107th floor. So he was really all the way up there on the top. And you could tell from that gaping hole that he was above the impact. And because of the fire and smoke, I just was frantic that, you know, there was no way he could get out. And as it ended up being, he didn't get out. I ran downstairs immediately and went to my Rolodex. Back then, that's what we used, and started looking up phone numbers of the other Cantor Fitzgerald wives that I knew and asking them, have you heard from your husband? No. Have you heard from your husband? No. You know, nobody had heard from their husband. So you started to have this very, very dreaded feeling that they were all, you know, up there together, trapped. I later found out that a few more phone calls had been gotten out, but we weren't hearing from the Cantor people. And as the day went on, and we knew that some people, very few people, had gotten down on elevators, again, that was below the impact. And Tom and nobody from Cantor Fitzgerald survived. I mean, there were 658 people that were killed that day from his firm.
Would you mind, I'm talking to Terry Strada. She's the national chair of the 9/11 families. Ms. Strada, this may be tough, but your kids are now older, but at the time, how does a mom handle explaining to the kids, one going off to, you said, preschool, what do you say, if anything, at all?
Yeah, it was a very difficult time in my house, obviously. I was struggling. I kept them downstairs away from the television set, and I was upstairs. My mom and I were taking turns taking care of Justin and tending to both of them because clearly Caitlin did not go off to school that day. And I had made the decision to keep Thomas home because he wasn't feeling well. So I had all three of them in the house, but I couldn't allow them to see anything. And I waited a day or two. I was very much afraid if there were any survivors and had he been in the hospital, but let's just say he was, you know, not doing very well, I didn't know what to tell the kids. So I just waited a couple of days and kind of made sure that nobody from Cantor got out. When I sat them down, right, they were 7 and 4 days old, and the first grader compared to a nursery school child. I just tried in the most gentle way possible, but you still had to tell them it was bad guys, you know, and that it was airplanes. I mean, it was a terrifying story to tell them, no matter how I tried to tell them. So I just did the best I could, you know, that the angels came and got Daddy because he wasn't safe in the buildings anymore because the smoke was so bad that the angels came and took him.
That's probably the most, you know, the best thing that a mom could ever do. Now, you know that the rest of us, I mean, I was in the news business at the time, and we were all glued to this, and much of America was. Did you find yourself watching the coverage that day, or did you find yourself repelled by it?
A little of both. You know, I would say after his tower came down, which was the second one to fall, I don't think, you know, I watched very much. I know I went outdoors a lot to cry and to try to kind of comprehend what was happening. You know, it was really a difficult thing for your brain and your heart to comprehend. Because I did feel at that moment he was gone when this building came down. I felt all of them were gone. You know, I had a lot of friends up there, too. His entire desk was killed. So the idea of how many people I knew could possibly all be gone was really overwhelming. But by the evening, when the kids were a little bit more settled down, I started to watch again. I think I turned the TV on when I saw cheering, you know, in Pakistan or somewhere where people were cheering the attacks. And that's when I really became revolted. I was heartbroken that anybody could cheer on, you know, such mass, you know, murder and destruction. And I just didn't. Then I had a whole new thing to have to try to comprehend.
I'm talking to Terry Strada. She's the national chair of the 9/11 Families and Survivors United for Justice Against Terrorism. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
It appeared to bank sharply and smash directly, perhaps purposefully, into, oh my goodness.
Oh God.
There's another one. Now it's obvious, I think, we have a terrorist act.
That was 20 years ago on 9/11/2001. This is First Amendment Friday in 2021. Welcome back to the program. It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let me make one short point, though. Last night, we saw President Joe Biden come out on national television and announce an illegal vaccine dictate, along with his really nasty language about how the government is losing patience with the free choice of citizens, and he wants us to straighten out, or you may find yourself without a job. So a nationwide vaccine mandate, not just for all federal employees, except, of course, the ones represented by the Postal Workers Union who are somehow exempt from that national mandate. And then you've got Joe Biden saying, we're going to have this mandate. I want to remind you of something that's a fact. Now, you hear a lot of opinions about Joe Biden from me. The fact is that for about the last 6 months, everything that Joe Biden has said, everything that the people who work for him have said, have promised, we will not have a mandate. It is wrong to have a mandate. We should not have a mandate. You'll recognize a lot of the voices in this little montage of sound bites from Joe Biden, Dr. Fauci, Jen Psaki, and everybody else. Take a listen to it. The vaccine mandate bite, please.
No, I don't think it should be mandatory. I wouldn't demand it be mandatory.
There will be no nationwide mandate. I was referring to mandates by private institutions and portions of the federal government. There will be no federal mandate.
One that's not the role of the federal government.
I don't think you'll ever see a mandating of vaccine, particularly for the general public. But you would never mandate, at least I do not think you would. I'd be pretty surprised if you mandated it for any element of the general public.
Now, even Rochelle Walensky, the head of CDC under Joe Biden, less than a month ago was testifying there will be no mandate. She went on Twitter and she said that's something that the administration is looking for. And within less than a day, she came out and publicly said, no, I misspoke. The administration is not even looking at this. We're not even considering it. I think we should adopt a new rule. Whatever Joe Biden and his handlers and his minions have to say, just assume they will do the opposite. When Joe Biden in the middle of last month said, we will not leave Afghanistan till every American is out of Afghanistan, when you hear those words come out of his mouth, you should immediately assume there will be Americans left in Afghanistan, as there were. When his people and even Joe Biden say it would be wrong to have a vaccine mandate, we will not do it, we're not looking at it, we're not even thinking about it, the minute they say that, just assume that's exactly where they're going. Anyway, it's First Amendment Friday. Glad to be with you on September the 10th, 2021. At 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today. Tomorrow marks 20 years since 9/11. Do you feel safer? I'd have to say no. I don't think our government got the message. I think that many states have decided, like Oregon, that waited and waited and waited and still really doesn't have full real ID because it interrupts one of their other goals, and that is to legalize the status of illegal aliens. So Oregon held off and held off and held off. And even today, they're still issuing licenses. Some of them will be enhanced so that you're a real American. Some of them will be made for illegal aliens, even though less than 10 years ago, Oregon voters by a 2-to-1 majority said no to driver's licenses for illegal aliens. What do our government masters say? We don't care what the public says. Shut up and pay your taxes. Let's go to Randy, who's a naysayer. Randy, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about?
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on.
You bet.
No, I'm really confused. I'm super confused. I've read about, you know, 911. I've read about thermite being painted in the basement. I've read about the elevator 9-month project where nothing ever happened. I'm confused, like a lot of Americans. What happened? Did the Afghans and the Pakistans attack us, or was this really done on our own ground, by our own people?
You're saying that this was a conspiracy within the United States government to deliberately destroy those buildings, murder 3,000 people, fake the attack on the Pentagon, fake the crash in Shanksville. There are so many problems of those conspiracy theories, not the least of which are physics. So, Randy, what really happened is Islamic terrorists took over 4 airplanes. They crashed 2 into the towers in New York, 1 into a field, thank God it didn't get to the Capitol, in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and 1 went into the Pentagon. And Randy, I've gone the distance, I think, in debunking a lot of these things. The nonsense about wiring that building to bring it down in a controlled implosion because it would have been impossible for an airplane. I've heard the theory. And then I got people on who actually blow up buildings, implode buildings for a living, and say, could you have done it? They said, we could have done it. It would have taken 6 weeks of work. We would have had to cut holes inside the building. We would have had a det cord or a igniter wire, whatever they call it, strung all over the interior of that building to set off explosives in a particular pattern. And I said, could you have done it without anybody in the building seeing you doing it? And they say, no. And then I've read the NIST report. I've read all of those. Randy, if you believe in those theories, I'm not going to try to dissuade you, but I think they're just crazy internet theories, unfortunately. What do you say to that?
Well, Lars, I appreciate that, but how do you debunk 9 professional bomb experts saying there's no way a plane could take that down? How about
because of physics and the NIST report, which is some of the top engineers in the country who were detailed to go in and look at this and say, tell us what happened. And what happened, actually, as a matter of physics, isn't that hard to understand. It's sad because it took the lives of, you know, more than 2,500 people in those, in those two buildings, and then many, many more in both the Pentagon and the field in Shanksville. But here's the way it happened, Randy, according to the engineers who know how to do it. Now, I can find 9 engineers almost anywhere in America who will tell you we never landed on the moon, that manned, heavier than air flight is. I can find engineers who probably tell you almost anything. But I can tell you what the engineers who studied all the evidence said. They said, when you take 2 airplanes that are loaded with enough fuel to power that jetliner for 5 hours in a flight across the country, and you ram it into a building at high altitude, and the aircraft burns, that what it does is it weakens the steel, because you understand those buildings are built out of concrete and steel. And when you weaken the steel girders enough, the floors of that building weighed, if I remember, I'm searching my memory, I think it was about 2 million pounds of rebar and concrete in each floor. So when you weaken one floor and it drops and the whole 2 million pounds lands on the floor below it, which is also weakened by the fire, and now you have 4 million pounds of floor that falls and hits the floor under that, you can see it's more than dominoes because it starts to add up as it comes down. And that all the engineers said, that's how the building came down. Now, if you want to find a few engineers who will tell you almost anything, sure. But when I've looked at the sum total of all the data and all the engineers who've looked at it, it was a terrorist attack on America. It was not an internal conspiracy. And for the life of me, I can't understand how the conspirators would have benefited from it. But Randy, you can believe what you want because it's a free country. You can also get vaccinated if you want or not. It's a free country as long as we can keep it, as Ben Franklin warned us. It's First Amendment Friday. We'll be back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
When I saw a second plane at a tremendous speed go into the second tower, it was then that I realized the world was going to change.
That, of course, is President Donald Trump speaking about the attacks on 9/11 20 years ago tomorrow. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. But there's an intriguing notion out there, and the man behind it is Andrew Bacevich, who's president of the Quincy Institute and the author of a brand new book called After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. Andrew, welcome back. How are you?
Glad to be with you.
I want to know what you mean by this, that America's role in a world transformed, and whether or not 9/11, the terrorist attacks 20 years ago tomorrow, were an event that didn't just energize us in some ways and cause us to react, but also cause us to perhaps start to pull back as a world leader instead of leaning forward.
Well, I think it caused us to react, but in my judgment, the reaction was the wrong one. The Bush decision to declare what the president called a global war on terrorism, but then the target, what he referred to as an axis of evil, three nations not involved in 9/11, I think sent us down a path of what others have called, you know, never-ending war, forever war, permanent war, and has done significant damage to the country, in my estimation.
We should have included Saudi Arabia at the top of that list. Is that part of the theory?
Well, I mean, what you're referring to, I think, is that, yeah, guess what? 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. That doesn't automatically mean that the government of Saudi Arabia was implicated, although
understood.
I think questions remain in that regard. But I think what it does mean is that the way that the Bush administration lined up the good guys and the bad guys in the wake of 9/11 was too simple, that the entire thing had a complexity that the Bush administration didn't want to acknowledge. They were gung-ho to go after Saddam Hussein. I think that Bush's advisors were persuaded that if we went after Saddam and won quickly and decisively, that all kinds of positive secondary effects would follow. Of course, we didn't win decisively. I mean, it looked briefly as if we had, but when Iraq turned into a quagmire, the basic assumption informing the global war on terrorism from the Bush administration's perspective had turned out to be wrong.
I'm talking to Andrew Bacevich. His new book is After the Apocalypse, and he heads the Quincy Institute. I wasn't only referring to the 15 of the 19 were Saudis. I was also referring to where the funding seemed to come from. And I would guess in the United States, you might say funding of private enterprises, even if they're terrorist enterprises, isn't always done or even often done with a sign-off of the government. But I doubt that there's very much that happens in the Saudi kingdom without at least the acquiescence, if not the support, of some parts of the Saudi government. And that's what I thought was the more significant thing, not the nationality of the people who did the deed, but where their support came from, financial especially, because that's critical to a terrorist organization, right?
You're making an important point, and I do not want to pretend that I have an intimate understanding of you know, internal Saudi politics, but it does seem to be the case that there are a host of question marks about the relationship between Al-Qaeda and bin Laden himself and members of the Saudi elite. You know, the money was coming from somewhere. It does not prove that senior Saudi officials were implicated. But 20 years later, there still are too darn many unanswered questions in that regard. I think, actually, the recent decision on the part of the Biden administration to direct national security agencies to declassify relevant materials in that regard is a good thing. Now,
I agree. But was it done? But Andrew, I think it was a good thing to tell the American public more information. But was it done because the Biden administration thought it was a good idea, or because they were getting a black eye from the 9/11 families?
Oh, I don't know. But I share your suspicions that it was pressure from the families, on the eve of the 20th anniversary, made for a politically potent set of demands, and you know, I'm guessing that's probably why Biden gave in on this point.
I mean, I just wonder about that, because the families are still fighting a fight about holding the Saudi government responsible. And if you say, well, they weren't, well, there's a disagreement, fine, let it go to court and let a court hear all the evidence and then make a decision. Were the Saudis responsible? Because while I say that, Andrew, I'm not that crazy about the Saudis. On the other hand, I think in some ways that we've treated them like allies, and to some extent they've acted like allies in other Middle East problems that we have. And so you say, well, what do you do if you think they're critical to being able to make sure that we protect this country here by having at least some friends in the Middle East who will go along with us and support us when we need it? But then to protect them if they played a role in the worst terrorist attack on American soil, I don't see doing that. And yet the two kind of contradict, don't they?
Yes. You know, just in that presentation you just made, you're using terms like allies, friends, that's the sort of the orthodox language of foreign policy and international relations. But when you think about it, that kind of vocabulary really doesn't work when we think about the relationship between the United States and nations, particularly in the Arab world, you know, in the Middle East, that have been useful for us in some respects, where there has been a coincidence of interests in some respects, but there's been no coincidence of values. So the language, in its sense, is not fully relevant to the complexities of the circumstance.
By the way, Andrew, I take them as fighting words if you're saying I'm talking like the people of the State Department, because I'm not crazy about the U.S. State Department either, because I think they've got problems. But, I mean, throughout history, we've had lots of folks. The Russians were, to some extent, useful to us in World War II, and then they weren't for 50 years. And the Japanese were enemies, and now they're allies. And China was at one point helpful to us during World War II, and now not so helpful today. So a lot of shifting alliances out there.
There's no question about it. And again, what I was referring to is what I think is the standard or orthodox language that's used to describe relationships between countries. And we talk about friends. I mean, I think for serious people, there are no friends in the relationships between nations. Maybe we could say Canada is our friend. But I'm not sure I'd go much beyond that. The relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia is based on common interests, specific common interests. And the pursuit of those common interests at times requires us to ignore a behavior on the part of the Saudis, which is anything but friendly. And I'm not picking on the Saudis, because I think you can make the same statement about U.S. relations with Israel, with Germany, with Japan, whoever.
Absolutely. That's Andrew Bacevich. His new book is called After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. It's a brand new one. Andrew heads up the Quincy Institute. We're glad for his insights, and thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment. It's First Amendment Friday. I'll get to your phone calls and your emails.
These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat, but they have failed. Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve.
Welcome back to the Lawrence Larson Show. That, of course, was President George W. Bush, who was president at the time of the terrorist attacks. Welcome back to First Amendment Friday as well, where we always honor naysayers. Let me go to naysayer Greg. Hey, Greg, welcome to the show, and what do you and I disagree about today?
Lars, this seems like this week you've really irritated me, and that's good and bad.
And I've been doing my job. It's honestly provocative talk radio. I've provoked you. So what are you provoked about?
We have talked in the past about this a little bit, and I just want you to hear me out, and then I'll let you speak all you want. I work for a major airline, the Friendly Skies, and I worked for them for 30 years, and I made a good amount of money. I made $35 an hour.
Good.
I had a good insurance program. My CEO makes $26 million a year without stock options. And you say unions are no good, and it's up to us if we want to join them, but a lot of cases you have to join a union, because I joined the union at the Friendly Skies, and I have people that work next to me in other airlines that make $17 an hour with hardly any health insurance. Now, do you think without a union I would be making $35 an hour?
I think you'd be making market wages. And, Greg, you've just suggested four or five of the reasons I don't particularly like unions. Now, when I say they're no good, I think they've wrecked the public schools. You might even agree with me on that. I think that I have always said that under the Constitution, if I have freedom of association, then I have the right to associate with other people of a common interest. It can be the NRA, could be the Sierra Club, could be whatever group you want to belong to. You can also belong to a union. And federal law and state law support your right. So I'm not going to ever deny somebody, if you want to belong, go ahead and belong. But when you get down to what they actually do, were you the best pilot at the airline you worked for?
Well, I wasn't a pilot. I was a ramp serviceman. But
okay.
Yes,
were you the best
job.
One?
Yes.
Were the best? Yes. Okay. Everybody else was inferior to you in your particular line, right?
No, I'm just saying my main objective here is that there was people out there working 40-hour work weeks making $17 an hour with a turnover rate of 83%. I worked for a major airline that was paying me $35 with an average turnover rate of 4%.
Sure,
and
but Greg, you've
$26 million a year. Why shouldn't we have an adequate wage?
Well, what do you call? I don't believe in adequate wages. I believe in paying for what the market says something is worth. So, for instance, right now you want to hire a contractor. Contractors are in short supply and high demand, so it pays a lot to be a contractor. I don't begrudge them that money. If at some point Joe Biden crashes the economy, nobody's got money for building houses or remodels, or the demand goes down, the contractors will make less. That's called the marketplace. Now, would you mind telling me, how does the union obtain, say, 50% more pay for you as a member of the union than the market pays anybody else for doing the same job?
You said you let me answer. Go ahead. We negotiate a fair wage, and the company decides if that's sustainable or not. Now, just like you do when you do your contract, you have a lawyer or an agent that negotiates a contract for you. You can either take it or leave it. Well, in my situation,
Greg, working for the major airline,
I have to take it.
You left a little teeny bit out of it. You know why?
Because
I came to you and I said, Greg, I want you to sell me your house. And you'd say, okay, let's see what the market is for houses of my size, neighborhood, and everything else. But if I said, Greg, if you don't sell me your house for $50,000, I'm going to park big trucks in front of your house so you can't see anything, you can't leave your house, you can't get your car out of the driveway. I'm going to block you in. I'm going to find a way to cut off your power. You're not going to have any electricity. You're not going to have any water. Now, sell me your house for $50,000. Now, that's what a union does. It says either pay our members what we're demanding, or we will shut your factory down, we'll damage your relationship with your clients, we will make it impossible for you to do business. If I could use those tactics, Greg, union tactics, to buy your house, you might sell me your house for $10,000. Would you agree?
Well, now we're straying off a little. We're talking about a house.
No, we're not.
I'm
making a comparison. Everybody would sell their house for whatever the market is. If the market's down, you're not going to get as much. If the market's way up, the average in the Northwest now, year over year, is 24%. And if you say, like you said about your CEO, well, why should somebody get 24% more for a house this year than last year? And my answer is simple. Two words, supply and demand. That's what's guiding it. But when it comes to unions, unions put a gun to the head of companies. And they say, pay us what we want, or we will hurt your business, we'll shut you down. and we'll make it impossible for you to operate. Just as I said, Greg,
that's not true.
It's not true. Unions don't use those tactics.
We look at the profits and losses of the company. If they're making, which most airlines do, $2 to $3 billion a quarter, and most of their money isn't made from people getting on the airplanes. Most of their money is made from charge cards that they put out. The United card, the Alaska card.
Okay, but that's a side issue, Greg.
That's money they make.
What does the union threaten to do if they don't get what they want?
Well, the company could say no to and break the union. They have the right to do that.
Yeah, except that your union, there are unions that have struck companies for as long, believe it or not, as 30 years to force. And as far as I'm concerned, Greg, I consider that extortion, but great naysayer call. It's First Amendment Friday on the eve of 9/11. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a First Amendment Friday. I'm glad to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. But I've been looking forward to talking to Peter Boghossian again for quite a while, and especially this week, because he's become kind of a national cause celeb, now former assistant professor of philosophy at Portland State University, and not fired, but decided to leave the university because, as you put it in part of your letter, Professor, I never once believed, nor do I now, that the purpose of instruction was to lead my students to a particular conclusion. Rather, I sought to create the conditions for rigorous thought and help them gain the tools to hunt and furrow for their own conclusions. That's why I became a teacher and why I love teaching. But brick by brick, the university has made this kind of intellectual exploration impossible. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Lars. Ex-professor, I heard that and my whole heart started singing, and you can call me Peter.
Well, Peter, I appreciate it because you've been on the show before. I've followed you for a long time on social media and such. You've also written a book called How to Have Impossible Conversations, although it sounds like the conversation you were having with the management at a taxpayer-funded, taxpayer-owned university, PSU, became an impossible conversation.
Yeah, that's right. And many of my colleagues simply did not want to have those conversations with me, nor the administration. I asked the president in a series of emails to have a five-minute meeting, 5 minutes. And I was told by his staff repeatedly that he's too busy. So I think that there is a problem. You are correct, to be sure, that it's even more of a problem because it's at a taxpayer institution. That said, this ideology has its grip on universities throughout the English-speaking world. And so it's not just a problem because it's at a taxpayer-funded university, although admittedly that does make the problem somewhat worse because taxpayers are then funding illiberalism and censoriousness. But it's a problem everywhere.
I agree with you, Professor. And you know, on this show, we cover this. I mean, Harvard's got problems, private institutions, but I always feel I have a little less latitude because a private institution can do whatever crazy thing it wants to do. But when it's taxpayer funded, taxpayer owned and operated, that, you know, while we don't spend all the money, most of the funding, even on the private universities, is at some level going back to government grants, government research, students that are paying for their tuition with government-backed loans, you know, all of this stuff, an awful lot of dollars that support all higher ed institutions, both public and private, are coming
Correct.
From the taxpayers. So we got a dog in the fight. You're leaving, and I got an email, or not an email, there was somebody put up a post, and they said, hey, Boghossian's leaving because Betty wouldn't have left if he got tenure. Tenure was an issue, but I wrote back and I said,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have to interrupt you.
Yes.
I forget. It's one of the things in How to Have Impossible Conversations I think don't do, but I'm going to do that. I wasn't tenure track, so there was no getting tenure. That just wasn't in the card. So whoever wrote that is either profoundly ignorant or just lying.
Probably a little of both. But what I wrote back, you know, because I didn't know that you weren't on tenure track. But I said, look, if he got tenure, he'd have been just as free, even more free, to write the letter he wrote about all the flaws of the university. Because under tenure, I guess unless you do something really egregious, they really can't fire you. So would it have been fair if you had been on tenure track, you could have said, now I can write all kinds of criticism of anybody I want, the university, the president, Xi Jinping, whoever you want to criticize. And unless you really went way over the top, the university isn't going to bust you, right?
Right. So I think it's really important to use that, the two things that are going on here. Often the even getting tenure, that process, you have to keep your mouth shut. You have to play along. You can't rock the boat. If you do that long enough, that habituates a kind of cowardice in you. And it tempers your speech so that you're not forthright. And so I think that the very process of getting tenure enfeebles people.
Let me ask you about this then, because I want to make this relevant to my audience, because most of them, 70% or so, have never been in a college classroom, never will be in a college classroom, but they may aspire to put their kids there. What does this do when an institution behaves the way it did toward you and other members of the faculty to the kids that are going to go to that school?
That's a fantastic question. It makes them brittle. It makes them fragile. But I want to ask you a question, because I think that this is really, really important. So I don't like Marxism, and I know from what I know of you that you don't like Marxism.
No, I hate it. Yep.
Okay, great, perfect. So we're on the same page there. You and I have something in common, and that we both want intellectual diversity in the classroom.
Yep.
I firmly believe that there should be a Marxist in an economics department.
Okay.
Do you believe that there should be a Marxist in an economics department?
Yes, because, Professor, I've said to my audience 1,000 times over the last 25, I've said, listen, when I went to university, I went for a year and a half, they said, hey, you're coming to a university, you're going to have, and I've used that comparison, I've said, there will be Marxists in the economics department, there will be people who followed Milton Friedman, and everything in between, and you'll get exposed to all those ideas. And I thought, what a great idea. It's like going to a zoo.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to like the lions, but they're going to be there.
Okay, this is so important. So in the new culture war that we're in now, I'm an atheist. I don't know your religious leaning.
I'm not. I'm a person of faith. So
that's what I thought.
That's okay.
So we are in So we are in a new alignment now. And the alignment that you or I are in is we both want cognitive liberty. We both want people to have the freedom to choose what they want, the freedom of belief, the freedom to engage ideas, the freedom. I want you to be able to criticize my beliefs, religious or otherwise. I want to be able to criticize your beliefs. I want kids to be taught by Marxism. I hate Marxism. I think they need one person who genuinely believes it in an economics department who teaches them. And that's the difference between what I would, in a way, we're very much in a realignment now in our culture, in this cultural moment. And that's one of the fundamental differences between the people who are, quote unquote, on our side, even though we disagree about abortion, we might disagree upon a whole suite of other things. I don't know your position about gay marriages, but I'm very much for it. Even though we agree, we may disagree on those things, there are bedrock fundamental principles like how we engage each other. You have a disagreement with me. I don't wish you violence. I don't want to hurt you. And I know you don't want the same for me. I want you to have your cognitive liberty to pursue those things that you want. And the dominant moral orthodoxies in institutions now does not want cognitive liberty. And that's what this fight is about.
And I know your time is short. I'm going to let you go. But Professor, ex-Professor Boghossian, I started this show 25 years ago full-time. I said to my producers, naysayers go to the head of the line. I want to hear the people who disagree with me.
Absolutely.
And I want them to make a great argument. And then if I beat them in the argument, it has to be based on facts, logic, and the law, not based on me shouting louder or having the off switch. Peter Boghossian is an ex-professor at Portland State University. He is the author of How to Have Impossible Conversations, and he's a former assistant professor of philosophy at the great Portland State University, paid for by taxpayers and with an orthodoxy that just won't quit. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And, you know, imagine my surprise. I managed to talk ex-professor Peter Boghossian into staying for another segment. I think you should wear that as a badge of honor, Peter, because being fired or being made to feel so uncomfortable in such a hostile work environment that you had to leave a university that has adopted the kind of ideology that it has is in my book, I count that in your favor.
Thanks. I appreciate it. You know, you said something at the end of the last segment that I feel must be commented on.
All right.
And that is you like to have people who disagree with you on your show, and you like to present facts and evidence and have those conversations. So yep. I was just on Tucker's show, although Tucker was on vacation. He had a nice guy, Jesse, I think.
Jesse Waters is a great guy, and Tucker's a great guy. I know both of them. They're good guys.
Yes. So, you know, Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, every conceivable invitation to the right. I put out a tweet inviting myself and saying that I'm available for a conversation with, you know, the folks from CNN, with Rachel Maddow, with NPR, and crickets. And so I have a question for you.
Sure.
What does it tell you about a media ecosystem who refuses to listen to different, like yourself? You will have people with whom you disagree on your show. What does it tell you about a media ecosystem when they will not have people on the show who have substantive disagreements and are exposing what I think
they're intellectually bankrupt. They're intellectually bankrupt because ex-professor, I'll call you Peter. Peter,
please.
There are many things I like about America. One of the things, it's often problematic, but I like it, is the adversarial system we have in court. When we're making some of the most important decisions we make for individuals, whether or not to put them to death, whether or not to put them in prison, whether or not to take everything they have, we say, you are allowed to bring your champion into court and make all of, call all the witnesses you want. The other side, the state or your opponent, is allowed to bring in all the people they want and their best, you know, legal advice. And then you have a battle, an intellectual battle in a courtroom in front of at least arguably, neutral judge and a random selection of people from the general public. And then the decision is made. I think that's a very honest way to make those consequential decisions. Other countries, many of them, don't have that. They have kangaroo courts. And I think this is an intellectual kangaroo court if you say we're only willing to listen to one side.
Yeah, and I think it's more than intellectual bankruptcy, to be blunt. I think it's ideological corruption. And I think they've been ideologically corrupted. They won't even listen or entertain the other side. They're not willing to change their mind. I think that is one of the greatest intellectual toxins, if you will, to borrow a phrase from Christians, it's a sin. If there is any such thing as intellectual sin, that's it. It's sticking to a belief independent of the evidence, not willing to hear the other side. It's the opposite of 1 Peter 3:15. And that's what I see happening in our liberal media ecosystem right now. And I think it's a disgrace.
This is an ex-professor who says he's an atheist who knows the Bible. So that tells you his intellectual honesty extends to, I don't believe in this, but I'm going to read the book anyway. Peter, this is what has always bothered me. I think it's a form of cowardice, because if I tell you I really sincerely believe in something, and you say, great, let's have a debate about it. I'm glad to do that any day of the week. When somebody says, I believe in this, but I will not have a debate with you. I will not let you match, you know, wits and facts and logic against my position, that tells me you're afraid that if your position actually was scrutinized and you ask questions. I like asking questions on the show to show somebody that perhaps their position is not well founded. They say, no, you can't ask me those questions, or I won't give you answers. Well, that means you're a coward and you don't really believe it. You don't have the strength of your convictions, let's say.
Now take every single thing you just said and institutionalize it.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening in our colleges and universities. And it's going under the guise of safety, safetyism. I feel unsafe. This is my lived experience. You can't contradict my lived experience. I'm offended by that.
Well, but can you imagine this in another? And here's the part. Let me get to this because I don't want to waste this time. What I don't understand at all is that the board of trustees that runs the university, when they hire people to run the university, whether it's the president, the university chancellor, whatever they call it, provo, why don't they hire people and say, you know, I know you're all concerned about skin color and who somebody likes to have sex with and ethnicity and gender. How about some intellectual diversity? Why don't we have the Marxist and the guy who loved Milton Friedman and everybody in between? Why don't the boards of trustees insist on that?
Great question. It's because they don't value it. It's because they don't want it. What diversity actually means is intellectual homogeneity. That's why you'll never, for example, find a Trump supporter, for example, on a diversity panel. every time you hear the word diversity, translate that in your head as people who look superficially different, like skin color, what have you, height or ability status, but who think the same. That's why, for example, the man who may become the next governor of California, I don't know, obviously, Larry Elder, is not viewed as diverse. He is not viewed as diverse.
Yeah.
Because he does not have this. So diversity is just a smokescreen for people who look superficially different but think the same.
Well, I think it, you know, on that note, you've kind of now provoked me. I think it's actually bigoted because I have lots of friends who are white, black, Asian, every other color. I have friends who are gay. And if you said to me, Lars, you know, all black people like to eat the same kind of food, you'd say, Lars, that's a bigoted point of view because I don't believe that. But if I said that, you'd be right to call me out. They are effectively saying every black professor thinks the same way. And you say, hold on, that's not true. It's not even true among my black conservative friends. They don't all agree. And we don't care about the skin color. But a university says you must have this rainbow of skin color, rainbow of gender and sexual preference and all the rest of that stuff. And you say, and then we'll get diversity. And I say, not if they all think alike. And you say, oh, but if you're black, you bring a different perspective. That's saying it's no more or less bigoted than saying all of X category like this kind of food or this kind of music. And you say, well, that's a bigoted point of view. Well, if you're telling me that when you bring in black professors and Asian professors and white professors and gay professors, that's how you get diversity of thought. Why? I know plenty of white people who think alike, and whether they're liberal or conservative, they think alike. And I say, so you're not getting diversity. You're just getting skin color and sexual preference.
Okay. So you and I could have a long conversation. So we have to start moving toward a society. Look, let me ask you a question. Do you think race relations are better now, or were they better under Obama?
No, they became worse under Obama, and I think they're getting even worser under Joe Biden.
Go ahead.
We got. Unfortunately, I'm coming up to the break, but ex-professor Peter, we will have you back another time. And you can pick.
Thanks,
I'll tell you what. In intellectual diversity, you can pick the topic, and I'll meet you on that ground anytime. In the meantime, good luck to you in your ex-professorship. You're listening to First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday on the eve of September the 11th, 2021, 20 years since the terrorist attacks on the United States of America. And the other day on either Twitter or Getter, one of them, I might have posted on both of them. I said, how is it possible that that France has managed to put its terrorists from half a dozen years ago on trial already, and ours are still sitting in the pretrial stages 20 years later? I thought I'd put that first to Noah Malgeri, who's a Bronze Star recipient for his contribution to planning and executing the opening stages of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and he's a former captain of the United States Army. Captain, thank you for your service in uniform, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Lars. It was an honor.
Is it possible that the mastermind behind the 9/11 terrorist attacks could actually walk free?
Well, I think it's possible that under the periodic review that they conduct and have been conducting under the Biden administration for folks who have been held in Guantanamo, he would be up for review and an assessment of whether it makes sense for him to continue to be detained at Guantanamo, and then he could be cleared for release. And that's happened before. But I would imagine that in the case of KSM, if there's one person left at Guantanamo or any facility, similar facility, to the extent that we come up with another one, if Biden actually succeeds in closing Guantanamo as he's pledged to do, then it would be Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You know, even if he's acquitted, don't forget, he'll likely still remain at Guantanamo under the same conditions that he's been for the last 17 years or so under the Patriot Act. He doesn't have to be released if he's acquitted. He'll still be held there, most likely. It would be incredibly politically outrageous for even Joe Biden, who has a building an increasingly intense track record of outrageous behavior and conduct and decisions, I think,
yes,
to release.
Yes.
Yeah. to release KSM. So I just don't see that he'll walk even if he's acquitted. The only thing that could really come of this that's constructive in any way, shape, or form is if he is convicted and they seek and obtain the death penalty and he is executed. But, of course, the military hasn't executed anyone since 1961. So it's highly unlikely that the status quo is going to change in any way based on this process.
Captain Malgeri, tell me this. I've always heard that justice delayed is justice denied. And I believe that that's true myself, both in personal decisions and personal offenses against people and in cases like this. If we don't have justice yet after 20 years, what is that saying about our system? And are Americans ever going to get real justice against the people behind the 9/11 attacks?
Well, it's a fantastic question. And again, this is sort of a stalemate situation because the United States government obtained evidence, inculpatory evidence, confessional evidence, not just about 9/11, but about a whole host of terrorist criminal activities by KSM under circumstances that have been, you know, characterized as torture at various CIA sites around the world, outside of the United States and in Poland and Eastern Europe, and then of course interrogation in Guantanamo as well, and even in a military commission in a military trial. Torture confessions are not going to be admissible. The rules of evidence are going to be looser. And hearsay, if it's probative and non-prejudicial, will be admissible according to the discretion of the presiding judge, as well as information that's obtained without a search warrant would be admissible in contrast to a regular court-martial or a civilian prosecution. If we remember, Obama was considering, I think, prosecuting him in a civilian Article 3 court in New York near World Trade Center, which would have been an utter fiasco. But I really don't think the only outcome that could change the status quo is if they seek and obtain the death penalty and it's imposed. That would bring justice. The problem is because of the way the evidence was obtained in terms of his confessions and then arguments by the defense counsel that be made that further confessions were the fruit of that initial confession that was impermissibly obtained through torture, they may not be useful.
Captain, as a former captain of the United States Army, I've got to ask you this. Are we going to get anywhere if, as a country, we have to continue to fight against the threat of terrorism and we fight by the Marquess of Queensbury rules and then we judge people based on such a complicated system that you can't get any kind of justice and nobody seems to have the guts to punish these people in any way, shape, or form, which seems to send a message of weakness to a group of people. You know more about this than I do because of your role in Operation Iraqi Freedom. We're telling all the terrorist actors in the Middle East, America's a country so weak it can't even get justice from these people. And that further emboldens them, doesn't it?
Yes, it absolutely does. I mean, he has actually stated to the Arabic press, you know, on more than one occasion, I believe, that this whole legal proceeding to him is just a continuation of his jihad. And don't forget, he was educated in the United States, North Carolina, obtained a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, became radicalized. You know, he was born in Kuwait, but he was a Pakistani, became radicalized, became disillusioned with the United States, opposed to the United States, and began to hate the United States. For whatever reason, after being exposed to some radical Islamist in preaching, but you're absolutely right. You know, think about he was captured in Pakistan, just like Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden, of course, was killed when they attempted to take him into custody. But it would've been a better outcome for KSM. As well, because now he's been waging jihad. Keep in mind, I mean, he's privileged in the sense that he was one of the first people to get the vaccine. He got the vaccine before many American citizens as the inmates. And I think there's only about 40 or so folks left at Guantanamo. So many of them have been released over the years. But yes, I mean, that's a small piece of the tragedy that has been the American geopolitical strategy of anti-terrorism over the last 20 years. I mean, he was captured in Pakistan, just like Osama bin Laden was killed and was found Obama. In Pakistan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Pakistan, so that's the headquarters of the Taliban. When the Afghan army and the Afghan government, which we sponsored, a tremendously efficient operation in the sense that we were able to maintain the stability and the peace of that country in the midst of the Taliban presence with a minimal number of troops, 2,500 troops or so. We were able to keep that country together and serve as a bulwark to Chinese expansionism, which is now completely underway. And Afghanistan is on its way to becoming the next Chinese client.
Chinese satellite, yeah.
Absolutely, just as Pakistan already has. Now, don't forget, the United States is the largest single contributor of money to Pakistan in the world. Now, but we give it in the form of free money every year, astronomical amounts of money. Although, to put it into perspective, and we've been giving money down to Pakistan since the late 40s. But still keep in mind that the amount of military equipment that we left behind in Afghanistan in one afternoon vastly exceeds the amount of money that we've spent in Pakistan over the last 60 years, even
Captain,
though we give so much to them. Yeah.
Captain, last quick question, because we're coming up to the break. Do we need a different set of rules for dealing with terrorists?
Well, I think the problem is they didn't encounter him in a combat situation. What you have to do is make sure that there's resistance sufficient to exercise lethal force and terminate him with extreme prejudice. So if he just gives up and he's captured with the assistance of the ISI in Pakistan and the CIA, then you have a problem on your hands. It's like you don't want the person to survive his capture attempt. And so you got to do it in such a way where he's going to resist. And then you can execute them. But yeah, I mean, we run into problems with drone strikes. They go wrong.
Yep.
They go awry. We just saw that in Afghanistan where a whole family of civilians was killed.
Absolutely right. Captain Noah Malgeri, a Bronze Star recipient, executed the opening stages of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Captain, thank you very much for your service. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show on the eve of the 9/11 20-year anniversary tomorrow, the date when terrorists attacked this country. And yes, we've had a few people call in with conspiracy theories. That's all right. I'm always glad to entertain them and then to try to say, well, that's not how it happened based on facts, logic, and the law and my study of lots of documents over the last 20 years. This segment is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit online or visit one of their three locations, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Let's go first to David in Enterprise. Hey, David, welcome to the program. It's First Amendment Friday. Everything's fair game. What's on your mind today?
Hi, I'm
David.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here. What's up?
Okay. My wife works for an organization with 50 or 60 people, and it came to me the other day. I had an idea, and I wanted to bounce it off you.
Okay. I don't know what all this extra sound is, Enterprise. Or David, can you tell me what it is?
Yes. Anyway, there is, with these mandates coming down, there's one or two people in every organization that are constantly turning people into OSHA, doing things like that. And it came to me the other day. I thought the idea came to me that we could possibly do what the late Rush Limbaugh did with Operation Chaos and actually flood OSHA with a ton of different complaints, because it sucks watching her go through these things where there's just one or two people constantly turning people in, doing all that kind of stuff.
That's an interesting idea, because it's effectively the people version of what they call denial of service in the computer world, where they say, we're just going to flood you with requests. And at that point, the state bureaucracy will break down. I'm not sure whether it actually achieves the end of getting the governors of Oregon and Washington to stop acting like dictators, but it might be a start. I'm not going to suggest it. I'm going to say the idea is out there. I'm not going to endorse the idea, because simply creating chaos creates other kinds of problems as well. But David, interesting idea. Let's go to Maria. Hey, Maria, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm turning down my radio and pulling
Thank
over.
You.
Okay,
Thank
so
you.
I am a nurse in a local emergency room.
Oh boy.
I am not criticizing anyone for getting vaccinated or not getting vaccinated. What I want your listeners to hear is that people are sick. They are coming into the emergency room with mild symptoms to very severe symptoms. There are very specific parameters to be admitted.
Right.
I want people to know when you come into the emergency room and you have to sit in the waiting room for 5 to 6 hours to be seen, please don't yell at the staff. Please don't throw things at me, because we are still dealing with heart attacks, strokes, abdominal pain, ruptured pregnancies, bleeding ulcers, broken legs, people having their saws cut their legs. All these accidents are still happening.
Yep.
And if you're going to choose not to get vaccinated, please don't put yourself at risk and go into bars if you have diseases. We are seeing more and more young people come in. They're feeling lousy. Yep. We feel for you. Take Tylenol. Go buy yourself a pulse oximeter at the Walgreens or Amazon and check your sats, because it's the pneumonias that are developing that are making people really, really sick. So that's my plea. I'm not here to negate or
Maria, you had a nice down. Can I ask you a medical question? I mean, it's a simple medical question, but here's one of the things that's troubled me. I won't bring up OxyContin or hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. But Maria, when Florida saw itself having a surge, the governor said, we're going to set up 1,500 clinics to administer monoclonal antibodies. Regeneron, I think, is one of the name brands. And now I'm hearing that that there is possible to get that stuff at a pharmacy with a doctor's, you know, approval and all. Why aren't the Northwest states going after that solution as a way of addressing the people who get sick, whether they're vaccinated or not, because both get COVID? You know, perhaps unvaccinated get it more than the vaccinated. But last week, Oregon said 20% of its deaths were among the vaccinated. Why aren't the medical institutions pushing monoclonal antibodies as a treatment?
Lars, I can't answer that question because I'm a nurse. I'm not a doctor. Okay. I'm not behind the scenes looking at all the options. I'm only here to say of what I'm seeing in the emergency department.
Don't abuse the staff. I totally, and keep yourself healthy and don't abuse the staff. I only ask that, Maria, because if you said to a doctor, doc, if we've got somebody who's starting to show symptoms and they could go get monoclonal antibody treatment at a pharmacy and we can keep them out of a regular bed and especially keep them out of an ICU bed, isn't that something doctors and hospitals should be pushing?
I can't answer that, Lars. All I can say is people go buy themselves a simple pulse oximeter and educate people on when to show up in an emergency room. And this could be said for any type, not just COVID, but any True. Kind of headache or vomiting. Keep yourself hydrated. But we have to legally, medically examine you. We can't advise you in the triage room, oh, it's just a headache, oh, it's just a cold.
Go I get that.
The medication.
I just wish, I would love to have a doctor tell me why they're not saying this man or woman isn't so sick yet. They might have COVID. We'll get them for a test. But we think maybe we should start them on Regeneron right now. A lot cheaper, as I understand it, than putting somebody in a hospital bed that we're told are in short supply. Maria, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. It's First Amendment Friday on the eve of 9/11, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.